Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For the moment, at least, the anti-American protests seem to be simmering down. But damage has been done. Lives lost, U.S. diplomatic property destroyed, and possibly, we still have to wait and see, U.S. prestige damaged, and the future of new Arab democracies even more precarious. While the fury raged last week, the Romney campaign saw an opening to attack the Obama record on the whole Arab Spring and more. Libya, Israel, Iran, Syria. The White House is pushing back hard. This hour on point, Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and the fight over U.S. policy in the Middle East. You can join the conversation. Do the protests and violence last week mean Obama blew it? Is Romney politicizing outrage and tragedy beyond American control? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Special welcome today to our newest listeners on WVGN-FM in St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands. Joining me now to try to weigh this huge swath of American foreign policy are, from Washington, Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Susan, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
From Kansas City, Missouri, we're joined by Ruhlmark Gerecht. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, was a member of the key neocon think tank, the Project for the New American Century, whose push helped build the case for the Iraq War, a former CIA case officer who worked extensively in the Middle East. He's also author of The Wave, Man, God, and the Ballot Box in the Middle East. Ruhlmark Gerecht, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
My pleasure.
And finally, we're joined by Robert Malley in Washington, Program Director for Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group. He was Special Assistant for Arab-Israeli Affairs to President Clinton, Assistant to Clinton's National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, and was a member of the U.S. peace team at the 2000 Camp David Summit. He was in Libya last week and just flew back yesterday. Robert Malley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Susan, first to you, big picture. Does it look like there's a pause or maybe even the beginning of an end to the protests we've seen, or is it still wait-and-see time?
Well, I think I would lean towards the wait-and-see time, truthfully. There are protests that continued into Monday. Several places around the broader region. There was in Kabul, there was demonstration.
Yep.
There was more in Pakistan, I believe, in both Karachi and Lahore. There was also protests as far flung as Indonesia. So I think it would be too early to say that the sort of rage has subsided. In fact, if anything, I think it underscores that we're in a period of extreme volatility across the broader Middle East, and that is a result of the political upheaval that has taken place in many of these countries over the last 2 years. And so whether or not the specific protests over the video subside, I think the forecast is certainly for more turmoil.
Robert Malley, you're just back from Libya. First, do you agree we're in a period of extreme volatility? It's sort of hard to deny, but then it could go away, I suppose. But if we are, how much of that lies at Washington's feet, at the feet of the Obama administration, Robert?
Well, first, now, I agree completely with what Susan said. I think the immediate trigger of what happened, the video film, that anger is likely to subside. We saw it in the past with the Danish cartoons. Mm-hmm. But let's not lose sight of the broader or deeper roots of what happened, which have to do with events in the Arab world, as Susan said, and also with a long-term widespread perception among Arabs and Muslims about the West and about the U.S. in particular. And I'm sure we'll talk about it later, about the U.S. policy in this. I frankly think it's time that we stop looking in the mirror and stop thinking about ourselves. Our role in all of this in the immediate events and in the Arab Spring was frankly quite marginal. These were events that were written and dictated by local actors over which the U.S. has very little, and I would say diminishing influence.
Ruhlmark Gerecht, first take here. When you look back at the events of the last nearly week now, do you see an indictment of Obama administration foreign policy, something deeper than that? How do you look at it?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that the Obama administration did that, or they could have done, that would have prevented these riots. I don't think the Obama administration has handled the Middle East particularly well since it came into power in 2008. I think it's obvious in Libya where this was a planned attack, and I actually don't think the video had much to do with the attack in Libya, and I think the statements by the White House spokesman were pretty silly, where he said that this was obviously just the video. It had nothing to do with the United States. It had nothing to do with the perception of the United States in the Middle East, which I think is just simply not true. We have throughout the region, Islamic fundamentalism is really the mainstream current throughout the Middle East now, and it is quite anti-American. It's anti-Western. There are profound historical reasons for that. So we're going to have to deal with that, and it's not going to go away. It is going to increase in volatility.
I want to drill down on that, but of course it's become a campaign issue. We have on Friday Richard Williamson. This is a former Assistant Secretary of State, now top Romney foreign policy advisor. And here's tape, Rumark, correct, Susan, Robert Malley, of him blaming the Obama administration for the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi and beyond.
I think what we're seeing in Yemen and Egypt and Libya is turmoil that's very disturbing, that crowds U.S. interests, and frankly is part of a pattern where they see less resolve and strength of the United States, and they feel they can have these sort of assaults on U.S. sovereign soil.
Susan Glasser, take this on. There's the big kind of message out of the Romney camp at this very important passage in the presidential campaign, saying, you know, the Obama administration has not shown enough resolve and strength. Two big words there. The apology comes up as well, that you can trace this trouble back to a fundamental posture that you hear Richard Williamson saying there was wrong, was weak.
Well, that's right. I think they're trying very hard to fit this into an existing Romney campaign narrative about President Obama, this notion that he goes around the world apologizing. Remember, that's the title of Romney's book, right?
Is No Apologies.
American, exactly, and it's all about American greatness. So they're trying to fit it into that broader frame of Obama as a sort of declinist leader. I'm not sure how much that resonates with people. At the same time, you see them coalescing, not only in that statement you cited from Rich Williamson, but over the weekend you had Mike Rogers, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, saying that this is part of an Obama administration campaign of what he called, quote, disengagement in the Middle East. I think on that one, I think they're going to have a tough time making that case to the public. Remember that it's both Republicans and Democrats. It's a broad swath of the American public that is eager to pull away from the military commitments in the region. And they are supportive, broadly speaking, in both parties, voters are, of drawing down the presence and the war in Afghanistan, ending the war in Iraq, which is what Obama is touting as his signature achievements. And in many ways, I think that people will look at this violence coming across the Middle East in places and countries like Egypt, where we've invested billions of dollars in aid, and people are storming our embassies. And you know what? The conclusion of many voters is going to be, why should we be involved anymore in this? And so I'm not sure that it's going to help Mitt Romney in his increasingly uphill campaign to be making this argument at this moment in time.
Rumark, correct. More resolve, more strength, whatever those might mean exactly, and the U.S. would not be in this position today. Do you buy that?
No. I mean, I think it behooves the United States to run towards the Middle East, not to run away from it. I don't think you get to run away from it. I think it will come back and bite you, and bite you quite severely. I agree with Susan completely that the Republican Party is running from the Middle East perhaps almost energetically as the Democratic Party. They may even be doing it more vocally. I don't think that's a terribly astute policy. I think it gets you into trouble. I think the Obama administration, one of its primary faults is that it actually hasn't really dealt with the Middle East. It would prefer to run away from it. It wants to pivot to Asia, whatever that means. I think it will come back to bite us. But I would certainly agree that if you listen to the Republican Party, even if you listen to the Romney campaign, you certainly don't get the impression that they want to pivot back to the Middle East.
But you've got Richard Williamson, Robert Malley, saying last week there's a pretty compelling story that if you had a President Romney, you'd be in a different situation now. They said we've got Barack Obama with a risk-averse, lead-from-behind approach, and how's that worked? Top foreign policy advisor to Mitt Romney. What do you say, Robert?
I think one can make a pretty fair, a nonpartisan critique of the Obama administration's policy in the Middle East. But what to say that a more robust policy, a sort of tougher policy would have prevented what we saw the other day or would have not led to it, I think that's not particularly serious. I don't think we should spend too much time because, you know, this is a bipartisan problem. If you go back virtually every president the last, I don't know how many, the last 20, 30 years, each one, whether it's President Reagan, Carter, Bush, Clinton, each on his watch has faced this kind of problem in one form or another. So I don't think it's a matter of President Obama being too weak or not engaged enough. I think there are three problems that this administration has to face, or any administration that will, if Mitt Romney is elected in November. And one is this problem that President Obama faces, which is the problem of the expectations. He came into office promising a new page, a new relationship with the Arab world. That hasn't worked so well, and I think that's partly why one could raise questions about his policy, but it raises broader questions about the U.S. role in the region. The second has to do with our reading of the Arab Spring, and I think there was a tendency at the beginning to probably be a bit too optimistic and to view it through our own experience as a democratic, liberal uprising. That's not what it was about.
And three, quickly?
Well, third has to do more broadly with our policies in the region and to what extent, and this is not an argument for changing them, but to understand that if we're going to continue some of our policies, particularly with regards to Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, those are deeply unpopular in the region.
Robert Malley, hold the thought right there if you'd
be
good enough. We've got a break right here. Robert Malley, Rulmark Garek, Susan Glasser, please stand by. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy in the Arab world. It's in our politics. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and the fight over U.S. foreign policy in the Arab world. With us, Robert Malley from the International Crisis Group, Rulmark Garek from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Here was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice. She was on, I think, five talk shows yesterday. Here she was on Fox News Sunday denying that U.S. policy is to blame for the riots in the Muslim world last week.
We're very vigilant, and we are of the view that this is not an expression of hostility in the broadest sense towards the United States or U.S. policy. It's approximately a reaction to this video, and it's a hateful video that had nothing to do with the United States.
Okay, there's a lot to talk about here, but Susan Glasser, is that credible, that all these riots and more that we've seen are not an expression of hostility in the broadest sense toward the U.S.? It's just about the video?
Well, not surprisingly, I'm glad you flagged these comments because they are inspiring quite a controversy today. And I think on two points, really, there's a pretty heated argument. One is, do these protests have something to do with the United States, broadly speaking? Are they very narrowly cast about the video? I think anybody looking at this and, you know, interviewing the protesters, you look at what they're talking about. And the bottom line is, number one, they believe that the U.S. government must have somehow had a role in making this film, and that has been expressed by protesters in many of these countries. And I think it reflects the nature of state-controlled media in the societies that they're protesting in, and they just don't find it credible that somehow the U.S. government wasn't in some way involved with this. So that's something that our government has to acknowledge and address in some way, first of all. Second of all, there's been a real specific dispute that's broken out over Susan Rice's claims.
Can I stop you right there for just a moment, Susan? Hasn't the government done that from the get-go? I mean, the statement from the Cairo embassy that Mitt Romney went after so early in this whole arc of events, wasn't it exactly that, disassociating itself from that video?
Well, yes, exactly. But I think that to say that it has nothing to do with the United States is perhaps a little bit of wishful thinking or head-in-the-sandism. You know, the people are outside the U.S. embassies protesting, not because they care about some obscure filmmaker in California, right? You know, they're making a point, a broad point about the U.S. But secondly, there's a real dispute that's broken out about Susan Rice's claims about what exactly happened in the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, the attack mm-hmm. that led to the death of Ambassador Stevens. The Libyan government officials are on the record now disputing her claim. She says it was a spontaneous protest. It wasn't planned in advance. They say no way, no how. Absolutely, this was planned in advance, and it was used by Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups to make a point, and they took advantage of protesters who might not have had anything to do with it. But there's a real factual and substantive dispute out there right now.
Well, let's hold the Libya particulars because they're really interesting. Real Mark Correct, what about the broad argument made by President Obama's ambassador to the UN that this is not an expression of hostility in the broadest sense toward the U.S. or U.S. policy? It's about a video.
I think it would be impossible to catalog the anti-American, anti-Western commentary in Muslim Brotherhood literature in Egypt. It is that large, that mm-hmm. abundant. Even in the literature of Ennahda in Libya, the dominant Islamist political party in Tunisia, it would be impossible to catalog the anti-American commentary. The notion that this does not have to do with the United States, with Western culture, with who we are, and how Islamic fundamentalists react to that is just silly. This goes back to, I think, the naivete that the Obama administration had, and particularly the president himself, has had towards the Islamic world since 2008. I don't think he had a firm grasp of what was going on in the Muslim world. He largely thought that the hostility towards the United States was a product of or byproduct of George W. Bush, of the Iraq War, of American hegemony in the region. And he didn't understand the profound cultural roots of this hostility. We are going to continue to see this. The one thing about globalization is that, to be a tad bit vulgar, they are in our knickers and we are in theirs.
Yeah.
Ever since Ayatollah Khomeini had the brilliant idea of putting a bounty on Salman Rushdie's head in 1988, you might say Muslim outrage has gone global.
But if hostility toward the United States, and you're suggesting a culture that behind and beneath the United States is that deep and that old, then can a map full of riots and protests be blamed on one administration, on this administration?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think there may be individual criticisms that might be pertinent. And I don't think the administration has done a particularly brilliant job of handling Egypt. Libya, it's difficult. There may be technical issues in Libya. Obviously, the security at Benghazi was perhaps a bit light. Intelligence collection was weak. And they may not have handled themselves brilliantly on the ground. The administration has actually not been terribly active in the Middle East. It hasn't really been terribly active in Egypt, and I think it should be more active. It should be more engaged. That is not going to prevent, however, Islamic fundamentalist leaders from deciding to go after you. It certainly won't stop an Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups from bringing up mortars and attacking a consulate compound. That is a larger issue.
Are you suggesting that, as many people interpret Mitt Romney as saying, well, we ought to be in there more forcefully? We ought to be, large and in charge, almost a big stick in there, maybe even military?
Well, I don't know if that's actually what Mitt Romney is saying. I have to confess, the views that come out of the Romney campaign are somewhat contradictory on the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So I'm not 100% sure of what they are arguing for. I think that they're certainly correct when they say that the United States government should not apologize, perhaps not even comment on a video or anything else that denigrates Islam. To be frank about this, much, if not most, of Western culture in the eyes of Muslim fundamentalists is degrading towards Islam. I just don't think we want to go there. It's a serious mistake. It's not only a betrayal of our own values. it actually does no good for Muslims in the region, and it does no good for those who want to have more tolerant, less violent societies.
Robert Malley, what about that? This administration, as administrations before it, has tried to distance itself from this kind of vicious attack, vituperative attack on Islam. Is that a mistake? Should they be saying, hey, it's not our problem, our values are free speech, and don't bother us?
I think it's right to say that we were disgusted by the video, which I think everyone that I've spoken to in this country was. I think it's wrong to expect that that's going to make a big difference, as we've all been saying so far. That's not only what this is about. It was a trigger. But I think the point we've been discussing, and I think it's very important to focus on it, just as some paranoids have real enemies, conspiracy theorists could have real conspiracies to point to. And in the Arab world, there's a history of viewing the West as an agent of conspiracy and destabilization and domination of their part of the world. Part of it is invented. A lot of it is very true. It's Europe earlier. It's the U.S. afterwards. And we can't ignore that when we look at their reaction to particular events. So I agree, this is not really only about the video, of course. If another country, you know, is a different country, a non-Western country, if that had been the source for this video, it probably wouldn't have provoked anything. But because
even little Denmark provoked quite a lot, no superpower.
But that's a European country. Again, yeah, I'm saying, Europe, mm-hmm. Europe and the U.S., you know, today the U.S., because it's the superpower, is the one that is viewed as the symbol of the West. But there's a broader view. The history, a very conflictual history between Islam and the West. And more recently, as I was saying just a few minutes ago, there are specific policies that simply confirm in the eyes of Arabs and Muslims that the U.S. is a hostile country. Policies towards Palestine, towards Iraq, towards Afghanistan, the drone attacks in Yemen. This is part of this sort of background context through which Arabs and Muslims tend to view the U.S. And the notion that because we sided with popular movements in Libya or perhaps in Egypt or elsewhere, that that's going to change these perceptions, that's an illusion. Those perceptions are very deeply grounded. Part of them are based on myth. A lot of them are based on reality. And just as it took a long time for them to build up, it's going to take a very long time for them to go away.
But within that context, and all American presidents deal with that, obviously you can do better or worse. President Obama brought a certain kind of promise or perspective to this. Here's some really interesting tape. This is back from February 08. It was on an MTV MySpace called Presidential Super Dialogue. And here was then Senator Obama saying that his background, growing up in a Muslim country, he spent time in Indonesia, would help him ease America's poisonous relationship with the Muslim world. Listen to this.
If I convene a meeting of Muslim leaders to try to bridge the divide between Islam and the West, I do so with the credibility of somebody who lived in a Muslim country for 4 years when I was a child. And although I'm a Christian, I have a sense of that culture that I think will allow me to more effectively bring about the kinds of cooperation that we need to go after terrorists and isolate them, but also to bring the Muslim world together with the Western world to pursue the kinds of strategies that will make everybody prosperous.
Barack Obama, Senator Obama, in February 2008. Now, Susan Glasser, here we sit in September of 2012. Does that sound naive, like a vain hope? Has it informed a policy in a way that's for good or ill, Susan?
Well, listen, there's no question that Barack Obama, the early leader, the presidential candidate of 2008, was a big believer in the power, the transformative power of rhetoric. And remember that not only did he say those words as senator, but he followed it up when he became the president with his famous Cairo speech. And, he and his aides really had the view that this was a key way that we were going to transform and start to undo some of that long and troubling history that Rob referred to of the mm-hmm. U.S. presence and support for these authoritarian regimes in the Middle East that have now been overthrown. You can't wash away history with words, and I think that's part of the acknowledgement and the realization of where we're at right now. That being said, I'm struck by the challenge that the Romney campaign is going to have if they continue to pursue this line of argument against Obama and his record. U.S. presidents, in particular George W. Bush, repeatedly found themselves to be the subject of protests like this across the Arab world, and in many ways for actions that the U.S. government was more directly involved with, whether it was Abu Ghraib or the Guantanamo Bay prison. You know, we've had
the Iraq war itself.
The Iraq war itself. We've had waves of protests in the Muslim world targeting the U.S. specifically over the last, not just decade, but several decades. And I think that's going to be very hard to put that at the feet of Barack Obama. People are savvy enough to understand that there's a long history and context to this. And frankly, even if they aren't, my guess is that the response on the part of voters is a pox on all their houses. This just underscores something that people here in Washington in the sort of foreign policy world are eager to push back against, which is the sort of let's just get the heck out of Dodge. You know, if they don't want us, that's fine. We've got nation building at home to do, which is another of Obama's lines that may have more resonance for people as they look at these troubling events.
Rule, Robert, stand by. I want to get you on that, but we've got a lot of listeners calling in here. Des Moines, Iowa, James is calling. James, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. We have had freedom of religion and freedom of speech for 200-plus years, and we still have problems with it. I don't think that it's irrational to think that they don't understand freedom of religion and freedom of speech where they're at. But I also think that we, as citizens, have an obligation. If that video had one iota of cause for any of the problems that were in the Middle East, that was treasonous. But I would like to point out, after all this discussion, there's only been one death on Obama's watch from the Arab Spring. And
well, I'm not sure how you calculate that. We had four Americans die in Libya last week, including a very prominent ambassador. But I mean, and treason, of course, literally, it's not. It's freedom of speech, and it may be distasteful. It may be stupid, but not treasonous. But what do you think about the way Obama has handled the region, James?
Oh, well, I think it's been fairly obvious. We're not engaged in another war. In fact, we're disengaging in wars. I, for one, am tired of our thinking that we run the world. What would we do if they wanted to come over and manipulate our government?
Sounds like you may be okay with it, James, and we've got that. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may. Ed in Nashville. Ed, you're on the air.
Yes, I disagree with this because I just wanted to say that we are, you know, remembering an image of Obama bending down and kissing the hand of a king in the Muslim world right now. I'm just an American voter, and what I see is the body language of Washington, D.C. is extremely weak. And that does not mean we have to be aggressive and battle-torn, but we have to operate from a position of strength. And if we knew ahead of time that this embassy was in a vulnerable location, then we should have put the military support there to support that embassy.
Ed, do you think we were better off going to war with Iraq? I mean, President Bush, what? He held hands with a Saudi prince. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on when leaders meet. But were we better off with that strong military profile that got us into Iraq, Ed?
Well, I think we have to be smart. And apologizing once we got started is not the right policy. And here we are at the brink of war with Israel. And I don't understand how we have supported democracy for over 60 years in the Middle East. And now when they need us most, we're acting like we're not interested.
You mean with Israel against Iran?
Exactly. We care about this nuclear business that's going on in Iran. And I don't understand why we're acting like we can work this out by talking it over the table.
Who do you think would be more ready to go to war with Iran? Romney? Obama?
I think, you know, I like the decisiveness of Romney, but I don't want to sound partisan here because the problem, the root problem is trust. United States policy must be trustworthy. And our military actions must be strength with wisdom, not stupidity.
Ed in Nashville, I appreciate your call as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. talking this hour about President Barack Obama, Governor Mitt Romney, and the fight over U.S. foreign policy in the Arab world. We're joined today by Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, Rulemark Gerecht, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Robert Malley, program director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Crisis Group. Robert Malley, what about Arab Spring? Here we are, huge upheaval in this region and an opportunity, presumably, for a country with as many contacts and interests here as the U.S. has to help guide and shape the future, if only from the bleachers. How do you think the Obama administration has done with this period of upheaval?
I think, generally speaking, we're not very good at that. We haven't been good at that historically. We weren't good at that. If you look at our track record, and this, again, it's a bipartisan comment, the track record in Lebanon and Iraq, in Palestine, the people we tried to help, we generally hurt, and vice versa. So how has the Obama administration done? I think it's an okay, but I think that's sort of a reflection of the fact that it couldn't do much more than it did. The notion that things done here by us could really determine who was going to come out ahead in the struggle in Libya, who's going to come ahead, assuming the regime of Bashar al-Assad falls in Syria, who will come out after that, that would be determined by what we do. When what we really are seeing is an empowerment by local actors who, as I said, have long memories and for whom the U.S. in general has not been viewed as a friendly nation, I think that really is an illusion, and we suffer from it because we do have this temptation to try to meddle in domestic affairs and sort of the minutiae of domestic affairs. And more often than not, I would argue it is boomeranged.
Well, but there's blowback, it seems, you know, whether we're involved or not. Rulemark Gerecht, the Romney camp is very strongly saying now we haven't been involved enough. We haven't been strong enough here. How do you assess the Obama administration's handling of the Arab Spring? I mean, granted, Robert's point that you've got many administrations over decades here. It's a long legacy of engagement, as successful and unsuccessful, and things maybe nobody can really direct. But within that context, here you've got, you know, a year and more now. What about the Obama administration's handling or response?
Well, I think George W. Bush was the first American president who actually suggested that the Middle East, the Muslim world, was not so religiously crippled that democracy had possibilities, and that they that the Muslims in the also had a right to live in freedom. Regrettably, when Barack Obama came into office, he distanced himself from democracy promotion, distanced himself from the rhetoric of the Bush administration.
Well, he distanced himself from their means of the Bush administration,
more
certainly, military.
I mean, I think he distanced himself from the idea. When he came in, he wanted to engage the Assad regime in Syria. He wanted to engage Ali Khamenei. He responded very slowly to the Green Movement in 2009. He responded very slowly to the demonstrations in Tunisia.
So are all these fires all over the map last week, are those George W. Bush administration's responsibility? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, what I'm saying is that it's the supporting democracy, of supporting democracy in the region is really very new for the United States, that the Muslim world was really the last region general disposition to support democracy came into play. It is going to be very difficult. The Obama administration, I think, has done a poor job in Egypt. It has not actually been fairly aggressive with rhetoric or in with the embassy in actually trying to support democracy and for criticizing things that are going wrong in the country. I think you should never underestimate the bully pulpit of the United States. I think it's extremely powerful. It has echoes throughout the region. It can actually support and aid those inside the country who want to create a more liberal order. It is going to be extremely hard. And what we're seeing, what we have seen the last week, is how hard it's going to be. But that doesn't mean you run. And I have to give, I think the Obama administration responded correctly when they said they weren't going to run from the release run from Libya. I think that's the correct thing to do. I would argue that they should be more honest and more intellectually serious and how they approach the problems, and they realize that they should state forthrightly, it does have to do with who we are. It does have to do with America's history in the region, and it's not going to be changed by someone with the name Barack Hussein Obama, who lived in Indonesia for 4 years. That was pretty pretty silly.
Susan Glasser, so here we are. It's going to be hard to handle for anybody. Given that, how do you think the Obama administration's done? And what about the Romney camp call for more resolve, however you interpret that in the region?
Well, as to the latter, listen, you know, when presidential politics collides with foreign policy, it's a lot easier for the challenger than it is for the incumbent in a way to be critical without having to outline what does a policy of resolve actually look like? How is it different from what Obama is doing? So, you know, I think that's, of course, Romney's looking for advantage there without actually spelling out a different approach to the region. But I do think that in many ways this discussion, this debate over whether Romney sort of stepped in it by criticizing Obama too quickly or too much while a crisis was still unfolding, has actually sort of obscured a broader debate that we're likely to continue to have for some time about what is the right American approach to these changes sweeping the Arab world. I think that Obama is potentially more vulnerable than it might have seemed initially on these questions. These are very tough and wrenching decisions, but it seems fair to point out that nobody's really all that sure, as Rel already noted, what is the Obama administration position toward Egypt, for example, where a leader from the Muslim Brotherhood has been elected, but it's mm-hmm. not entirely clear who's in charge. We're continuing to say we support the billions of dollars in aid that we give to the Egyptian military. But again, it's not even clear who's really in charge at this moment of the Egyptian military and how their relationship with the new civilian power is going. Let's remember that in Egypt, where the host country is responsible for the security of the embassy, it appears that for whatever reason, and we're not sure on whose order, the security forces were not deployed in sufficient force to protect the U.S. embassy, which is really a different situation than what played out with the consulate in Libya, for example. So I think you have real questions about what has the Obama administration's policy in the region been. Let's remember Syria, where a new report out today says that the toll in Syria among civilians during the civil war has escalated in recent months. We're talking thousands and thousands of dead at this point in this ongoing conflict. What is the Obama administration position there in the long term? Is it really feasible that we're going to stand by and do nothing? You know, these are important subjects for a national debate to be held on. I think that it's hard because in a campaign context, it inevitably gets boiled down to a very reductionist, I'm tougher than you kind
of
position.
Yeah. Robert Malley, the president was finally on the telephone with the president of Egypt, Morsi, and then security was supplied. Apparently that was a pretty tough phone call. But would the U.S. be better off overall with a kind of tougher, in-your-face stance? It seems to be, as Susan says, things get very reductionist. But that seems to be part of the message out of the Romney camp. Be tougher. Be less empathetic. Be more stern. Would that put us in better stead?
I think, as Susan said, this is really part of the campaign season, because you had Governor Romney on the one hand saying you got to be tougher, and then he took issue with President Obama for saying that Egypt may not be our ally. So I'm not sure who would be tougher in that respect.
Yeah,
I think it really was.
Yeah.
I think it was a point of simply contradicting whatever the president said, mm-hmm. and I'm sure it goes both ways. Again, I don't know what it actually would mean to be tougher. I think it's true that we have to stand up for what we believe in. And sometimes, in Egypt in particular, I think we're paying the price for having been for boycotting and for ignoring the Islamists for so long. And suddenly, when they come to power, we have to rush to embrace them. I think had we been more open to them in years past, we would have had a more balanced policy and approach to them today. But the other problem is, yes, you could raise human rights and issues of concern to us when you speak to Egypt, but are you going to do it when you speak to Saudi Arabia? Are you going to do it when you speak to Bahrain? There is this other issue. I think Susan has outlined some of the core issues that whoever is next in office is going to have to deal with, because it has been a pretty bad record of our approach to the Middle East. But there's also this issue of consistency. Now, you can't have the same approach everywhere, but Muslims and Arabs aren't stupid. They could see that if you say one thing in one place and you act completely differently somewhere else, they realize that it has more to do with our interests than with the values that we claim to be defending. So I don't think this is really an issue of being tough or not tough. I think it's an issue of understanding what actions produce, and also understanding, again, that people in the Arab world, we may suffer from a lack of memory. they, if anything, suffer from an excess of it, and they will not forget what we have done in years past and what we do today and what Europeans have done even further longer ago.
With all that, there's still the day-by-day needle to thread. Sally in Moline, Illinois. Sally, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make a quick point. I think what your panelist just said was perfect, actually, perfect segue. I think these people, they can be smart. They can get their own reactions. They can take this to the higher level. This is such a stupid video. Use this as a teaching moment. This is what the United States is about.
What, this video is what we're, a stupid video, as you say, is what the U.S. is about?
No. The video was so stupid. Use this as a teaching moment to say, this is not what we're about. We're about the free press. This is not how we express, you know, we don't limit people's ability to speak up for what they believe. You know, I just think that there should be, the rhetoric should contain, you know, higher thinking. I don't think these people are stupid.
No, but they've got a very different maybe position on whether or not that freedom is appropriate. I mean, there's a real cultural kind of crossing of swords right there, because our freedom of expression does permit this, and in most of these countries, theirs does not. But let me hold that for just a minute, Sally, and get one more here. Aji in Columbia, South Carolina. Aji, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. All the talk we're doing, I think what is going on in the Arab world, they wanted to have a freedom and democracy, this and that, but everything is just so new. I don't think they really had enough idea exactly what they wanted. This whole video thing, which was really not right to begin with, but this was just the excuse for those people with the 50%, close to 50% unemployment, this and that. This was their way of showing the frustration. United States became a, you know, like a target, but I would imagine they are really frustrated with the internal situation that they cannot control. The Egyptian election went to the Muslim world, and they probably were very unhappy about that. And this is just their way of showing their frustration, and they really don't know how to really communicate that idea.
Well, Aji, we've got it. I mean, some of them are very explicit in what they want to communicate. We see flags there that look almost like Al-Qaeda's flag being plastered on the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. On the other hand, you can't argue with the unemployment figures, and more must be frustrating for a lot of people there right now. I want to look at an area. I mean, we've been talking here about different approaches or approaches that may be similar. One huge issue where the camps seem to declare a different approach was really front and center this weekend. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in the U.S., and he was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday with David Gregory. Gregory asked him about his earlier warning that the only way to stop Iran was for the United States to draw a red line and act more forcefully on Iran's nuclear activity. Governor Romney has seemed sympathetic to that posture, but let's listen to the Gregory Netanyahu back and forth.
As a prime minister of Israel, has Iran crossed your red line?
Well, the way I would say it, David, is they're in the red zone. You know, they're in the last 20 yards, and you can't let them cross that goal line. You can't let them score a touchdown, because that would have unbelievable consequences, grievous consequences for the peace and security of us all, of the world, really.
So we've got red lines to think about here, Susan Glasser. Here's the Israeli prime minister in the home stretch to the U.S. election in this country saying, come on, it's time to draw a line. And, of course, there has been effectively war threatened there. Now, we've got all kinds of response online. Here's one listener in Vermont says, Romney is old school diplomacy. Threaten them. Show your superiority. Cow them into submission. Do what we tell you. The man is dangerous. What about on Iran? What's dangerous here? Netanyahu says not drawing a crisp red line is dangerous. You could take another view on that as well. What about Iran and the way the two might approach it, Susan?
Well, you know, I think that this was really, if it hadn't been for these attacks on the embassies and consulates, this would have been the big story of last week. A major and significant public rift between the Obama administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu over the question of how specific of a quote-unquote red line do we need to have with Iran to say, here's what we're throwing down. If you cross this line, then action will be taken. The Obama administration, starting with Hillary Clinton, and then the president himself have said, absolutely not. You know, we've made the red line, and it's the red line is that we don't consider
a weapon itself.
That's right, for Iran to get the bomb, but we're not going to play Netanyahu's game. Netanyahu didn't take no for an answer and went on in the middle of the U.S. election season, went on the U.S. talk shows this weekend to underscore his point. We spoke with Defense Secretary Leon Panetta on Friday night, had an interview with him. We asked him. He threw it down even more to Netanyahu. He said, you know what? Real men, real presidents, real prime ministers don't need red lines in the real world. That's not how it works. So I think you're going to see a continuing and escalating dispute between Israel and the United States over the question of how to handle Iran.
Robert Malley, do you think the competition of the home stretch of the election campaign may draw us closer to a possible conflict with Iran here? You know, the U.S., each of the contenders for the White House looking to man up or something cooler?
Well, I mean, we've cataloged over the last hour how many inane things have been said in the course of this campaign and some things that really don't make sense. In this particular instance, nobody wants to put red lines. Prime Minister Netanyahu hasn't said what his red lines would be specifically. President Obama hasn't. Mitt Romney hasn't either. When he was asked on TV, he basically agreed with the red lines that President Obama had put forward. So that really is not what the debate should be. And it is a debate that's simply trying to gear people up to understand the need for war, which without thinking of its consequences. I think it's obscuring two more important debates. One is, what is the nature of the proposal that the U.S. should put on the table to the Iranians? And the second one, much more controversial, can we contain a nuclear Iran or not?
We'll try and watch with some nuance here, even in the Sturm und Drang of election time. Our great thanks to all three of you for helping us do that. Reuel Marc Gerecht with the Foundation for Defense for Democracy in Kansas City, Robert Malley with the International Crisis Group in Washington, Susan Glasser with Foreign Policy Magazine. Our thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.